Welcome to OCG Recovery Radio, where we discuss substance abuse treatment and recovery. You can listen live at blogtalkradio.com/OCG Radio. Please note that the views and opinions of our hosts and guests are not necessarily the views of OCG, nor is it meant to replace professional advice or the advice of your physician. And now, here's our show, Roach on Recovery, with your host, Orville Roach.
All right, folks. It's been a long time coming. I think we've been off the air for maybe over a full year now, maybe more. There have been a lot of changes in the program atmosphere and the program continuum. Good things, of course, that have happened, but a lot of work over the past year and a half, so we've been a little busy, but happy to hop back on today and get back after another show, and we got a special one in store with a special guest. So with that, Mr. Host, how are we feeling? How are we doing today?
Pretty good. Ready to get right at it.
Beautiful. Lovely. So you, we have an interview, I believe, today of somebody who is a part of Daytop history. I want to give a little bit of quick background on our guest of honor.
Today we're going to be interviewing Jimmy Curtin. He's the former executive director for Daytop New Jersey. And as a part of our theme, preserving the history of Daytop, we're trying to talk to influential people, leaders, people who were leaders in the Daytop world, if you will. And Jimmy's one of them. So let's welcome Mr. Jimmy Curtin to the show.
Beautiful. Jimmy, so you're on live with us. Jimmy, how's the connection? Can you hear us?
Yes, yes, I hear you guys fine. How you doing? Good evening, or I guess by you, it's good afternoon is more in order.
It's good afternoon for us. Good evening to you, Jimmy. Good to hear you. Good to speak to you again. It's been a while.
Great to hear you, Orville. I believe I was thinking about it while waiting to join the program. I think it's just about nearly 20 years since we've seen each other. Isn't that incredible how time passes?
Yes. Before we get started, I want to just tell a quick story. When Joe Hennen first came out to California, I think not too long after that, may have been within the year, you came out to do some training. I don't know if it was your first time out to California. I think you said it might have been your second time out. But you committed one of the most blasphemies when you arrived because either known or unknown to you, I being a New Yorker, of course, you also coming from the tri-state area, was just still getting over the bitter taste, even though it was a year and change removed, of the New York Football Giants' loss in the Super Bowl. And you said to
so
me,
that would have been two.
You, I think you came out in sometime in early 2002, I want to say. Joe came out in October of 2001, and you came out some months after he arrived. But the Giants lost in the Super Bowl in 2000, and we were still smarting after that. So Chris, our brother Jimmy Curtin, comes out to do some training, and one of the things he says when he gets to us, he says to me, he says, "Orville, I'm interested in going to a 49er game. And okay. it was like a gut punch coming from a New Jerseyan to ask me, a New Yorker, about the 49ers and he wanted to go to Candlestick Park. And I think I said to him, I don't know anything about that, Jimmy. And it's blasphemy that you even suggest it.
Well, how can we blame him? He's got good taste.
So, Jimmy, did you ever
interject here, Orville and Chris. So what he's leaving out is it was Candlestick Park that was the attraction. It really wasn't the 49ers, but he's leaving out the most important fact of the event. And he came across with two pretty good tickets to a 49er Cleveland Brown game. And I remember being very surprised that day because the Cleveland Browns, and I guess it was back in 2001 or 2002, but the Cleveland Browns dragged the 49ers up and down that field that day and won going away. So, Orville, I grew up in Queens. I grew up in New York just like you. And
okay,
yes, go Giants. We finally won a game this past weekend, so everybody is basically levitating around this area because I thought we could be looking at an 0-17 season.
Oh,
but we
goodness.
Finally won a game this year, so all is right.
Yeah, all is right. Okay. So, well, actually, Jimmy, you answer the first question where we usually start with people, which is where are you from, where did you go to school, and then ultimately – how did you get connected with Daytop? So you grew up in Queens. Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to Christ the King High School and then Grover Cleveland High School in Queens, and then I went on to SUNY College. I went to Brooklyn. I went to college in Brooklyn. It's so long ago. And then wound up going into Daytop in 1984. And, I forgot. When I got out of high school, I went to New York City Technical College. I was going to study radiological technology, which is a nice fancy word for, or at least it was back then, to be an X-ray technician. And then, through not such positive things at that point, I wound up as a resident in Daytop. There was a local priest who used to kind of patrol the neighborhood to try to help get kids off drugs and steer them right. And that was Father Coleman Costello, right, who wound up starting Project Outreach. And wound up in Daytop and then went back to college, went to SUNY school to get a bachelor's and then an MBA at some point after that, after completing or graduating from Daytop.
Which Daytop facility did you go through?
I went through Millbrook.
Oh, okay.
I went through Millbrook. I was 20. Well, you know, I mean, I guess this is a tell-all radio program, right? But so back then I wound up in Far Rockaway and Entry and then wound up in Millbrook, an adolescent facility as a 20-year-old, but learned much later on that the admission placement for me was based on the fact that I had a valid driver's license and they needed drivers to drive the van. This is a true story, a valid driver's license to drive the vans, because back then, as you probably remember, we couldn't afford to hire house drivers. We didn't have paid drivers. We only had resident drivers. So, yes,
right.
As a young adult, I wound up in the adolescent facility.
So, Chris, just so you're aware, and that was very commonplace, that the quote-unquote adolescents were actually may have been up to age 21. Because even as late as 1989, when I went in, they were still, it was like the Mendoza line, 20-21, whether or not you were going to get sent to the adult facility or to Millbrook. And so there were very few people that were 21 years old in the adult facilities.
Okay.
So that was interesting. Okay, so how does Daytop, New Jersey, because I think when you were in Millbrook at that time, Daytop, New Jersey was just getting off the ground, just starting, if I'm not mistaken, in 1984?
No, it's actually 10 years later. It was 1994, and Father Joe at that time was the director, I believe, of the diagnostic unit in Rhinebeck, upstate New York, in Rhinebeck. And I believe that's when Monsignor tapped him to go open up the program in New Jersey, to go open up the first site in New Jersey. That was it was 91. It was the end of 91, they started taking residents. It was a core group of residents from upstate New York were sent to help Father Joe open up the facility in Mendham. It was the fall of 91, I believe, in early 92, then they started accepting new admissions. I went to work there then in 94. Father Joe recruited me at that time. I was the adolescent reentry director in Far Rockaway, Queens, and then joined the Daytop New Jersey team in 94.
Okay. And to your knowledge, how did Daytop, and I know the Monsignor used to just somehow magically get these wonderful deals, but how did this deal come about to get that wonderful, beautiful facility? Do you know?
There was a gentleman by the name of Sandy Lewis, who at that time was involved with a Wall Street firm and was referred to Monsignor O'Brien. And Sandy Lewis, I think at that time, had some high-level state government connections in New Jersey. At that time, Bob Del Tufo was the Attorney General. Robert Del Tufo, who you may remember, was a longtime Daytop New York board member, and they reached out. They were looking for very specifically a long-term, back then was minimum 12 months, a long-term facility for boys and girls with substance use issues. And somehow or another, there was a connection, and Monsignor O'Brien tapped Father Joe to go and explore certain locations. And very quickly, it all came to pass. I think, the first, matter of fact, the facility in Mendham, Orville, I'm not sure if over the years you ever had the opportunity to visit it, but the facility in Mendham was the first one they looked at, and that's where we wound up, putting the stakes in the ground, if you will. And again, that was, I believe, sometime earlier in 1991.
So just to refresh your memory, I actually did visit the facility, and it was in 2009 or 10, whenever Joe Hennin's retirement party was. And you actually took me and my wife on a tour of the place. And the only area I did not see, which was, I was thinking about it today, was the dorms. But it's just I don't know what it was like when it first opened, but when I saw it, I just told Linda, I said, man, this is like the adolescent version of the Swan Lake facility. So it was a very nice campus. So you arrive in 94, you say?
I left, I transferred from Daytop, New York to Daytop, New Jersey in 1994.
Okay. So when does the facility really start, you know, getting its feet, get cooking, and now you're almost like full of residents? When does that happen? What year would you say?
By the time I got there in 94, the facility was full. It was full. It was capacity always was 70, or maybe it. I think in the early days it was 50, and then Father Joe went, for the local municipal approvals, and raised the capacity, raised the census till 70. I think that's the way it happened. But by 94, when I got there, I mean, it was a full, vibrant house with teenagers, both male and female, undergoing treatment, you know, in school, working in the departments, running seminar. It was really something beautiful to watch.
And what was the relationship like between Daytop, New Jersey, and the regulatory apparatus in New Jersey in terms of the funding that you guys got and all of that?
Thank you, Orville. Yep, you've got a great memory. I think, sorry, by the way, I forgot about the tour when I toured you and your wife. The funding was, from the beginning, it was New Jersey Department of Juvenile Justice funding, right, came from Juvenile Justice, and the grant to start was a $1 million grant to launch the program. Mm-hmm. And I think we operated with that $1 million grant for a long time until other funding, you know, became available to us. So we learned how to bill Medicaid, and, you know, we started to get involved in, you know, with serving people with commercial insurance. But to get started, it was a $1 million grant. And I think that $1 million grant repeated, kind of rolled over that million for several years. I apologize for not, you know, knowing all the details on that, but I do know that the initial funding was $1 million from New Jersey Department of Juvenile Justice.
And where did the kids come from? All over the state?
The kids had to be from New Jersey. Like I said, originally we had a core group. There were a core group of quote unquote older members from New York that came down to help, you know, not only to participate in their treatment, but to be, you know, as what we would call today peer specialists, peer recovery support specialists. But the kids came from New Jersey. They had to have a, you know, reside in New Jersey to be eligible for the funding.
Okay. Was it known at the time, so it's still in this early 90s period, mid-90s, the nature of the environment where the facility was situated? This is what I mean by that. So Mendham, at least from my knowledge, is a pretty well-to-do area. Did you guys
very much so, still is, yeah.
Yeah, and so did you guys know that and say, hey, we need to develop a plan to kind of maximize what support we can get from the community? And there's a reason I'm asking.
Yes, and that's another great question, but let me just say this. So Father Joe Hennin knew that, you know, in the planning phase, at the startup phase, that if you knew Father Joe Hennin, and I know you knew him well, Orville, but your audience might not, he didn't always wear the collar. You know, he didn't always wear the collar. But when he went to Mendham to meet with the local board, you know, the local municipal board, the council, the mayor, Father Joe always put that collar on. But you're jogging my memory now. The facility had operated, I believe, since the 1980s and maybe before. The facility had operated underneath the auspices of what was then Muhlenberg Hospital, and it was a 12-step residential program for primarily people with alcohol use disorders. It was an adult treatment program, a 12-step program. So they had, I believe they had some financial issues, and they were kind of going out of business. So the community, the borough of Mendham, where we were located at the time, the borough of Mendham had already been, for lack of better words, kind of socialized, if you will, to the idea of that. I'm sorry, of having a treatment center, you know, in their backyard. So I believe that helped the NIMBY, you know, in that area. That kind of helped. And then the other thing, of course, you know, what I think probably in hindsight is the facility was already zoned properly. So, you know, and, you know, very often when we wanted to open up treatment programs, the local resistance was, you know, it was very strong. It was very powerful. Mm-hmm. People didn't want these programs in their community. They didn't want these organizations. The stigma back then was so much, you know, the stigma, as you know, I know you know that we still fight the stigma associated, you know, with people with mental health challenges, substance use disorders. But think about it back in the 90s, how it was. but the facility was already zoned in accordance. The fact that the landlord of the property were a group of sisters from St. John the Baptist, you know, I think helped. But very, I don't know if you remember, you might not have remembered, but I remember when we opened up the facilities up in Rhinebeck, New York, which was probably 5 years before this, and the resistance was incredible. They held us up in court for probably well over a year, maybe a couple of years, until we were able to, you know, take possession of that property and start carrying out our mission and serving people. But that really wasn't the case in Mendham because of those things I just described.
Right. One of the things they should tell people, especially about the Rhinebeck case, is that the town did fight tooth and nail. And I said, Daytop always eventually gets in because of the way the New York laws were written. But more importantly, once they got in, they were able to show the community how they would be a beneficial neighbor. And so it's the turnaround that always amazed me, the turnarounds of the attitudes of the people in the community once Daytop got in. To me, was the real story.
Yes, and over the years, we really benefited greatly. We benefited greatly by the local support, even, you know, not just in Mendham, but from the county in general. Mendham is located in Morris County, you know, in the northern part of New Jersey, and the support was just really incredible, you know, just from board members and donors and volunteers and people who would just give, you know, a technical expertise if we needed it. The support was just, it was really overwhelming.
So as the program moved into the late 90s, early 2000s, did you start to see any changes in terms of the regulatory environment, the funding environment, in the state itself pertaining to substance abuse?
No, that came later. That came later. In 96, we then opened our Morris County outpatient program, which was kind of a day treatment center, although we didn't call them. We called them outreaches, but it was a 9-to-5 program, and then it was an intensive outpatient program. And then we were invited to open up another outpatient program in Hunterdon County, New Jersey. At that point, in the early 2000s, there was a, not to the degree that's what's going on now, but there was a heroin epidemic, a rash of heroin deaths in that county, and they invited us to come and provide outpatient services in a county building. I'd like to say, too, Morris County was also, you know, Daytop, we wrote the book back then on dollar-a-year leases. You know, we got dollar-a-year lease here and a dollar-a-year you know, lease there. And Hunterdon County, what the counties wanted, they wanted us, we talked to them and we told them that even, you know, back then we were well aware that if people were going to recover, get on a solid path to recovery, they needed access to the full continuum of care. You couldn't just go for a year in residential, you know, in quote-unquote the hothouse, and then, you know, be sent back to your home community and experience that, what literally felt for people like culture shock, and be able to kind of maintain, you know, a path to recovery. So we talked to them, we convinced them, and they were more than happy to give us space to provide outpatient treatment. And in turn, you know, what they got in turn was, well, we were helping the members of their community. But when a young person needed access to that life-saving residential program in Mendham to get off the streets, get away from all the negative influences, you know, they were a priority admission there. And that kind of formula, you know, worked for us. We expanded, really probably didn't begin to see the and feel the regulatory changes probably, I would say, somewhere around, you know, the end of the first decade, or maybe 2010, we started to basically see this prevalent attitude about, hey, let's not send kids away from home. Let's keep kids at home. Let's keep them in school. And, you know, that was, it wasn't so much of a funding thing. It was a referral piece. And then the funding issues came also. I think back in 2008, 2009, we kind of went through that recession period. And it was pretty significant, I think, financially. The whole country suffered. I think back then it was what the banking industry kind of led the devastation, mm-hmm. if I recall. But bottom line is then, you know, the states of New Jersey started to tighten up the coffers, and we did feel it from a funding perspective.
Did New Jersey, Baytop, New Jersey, did they start to feel any effects from what was going on with Daytop New York and their financial struggles that were starting to come to the forefront in the mid 2000s, 2005, 6, 7, 8?
Yeah,
reputationally,
you know, we were always concerned. We had a very strong, very solid brand in New Jersey, and New York did too, but obviously when, you know, I remember that Saturday morning now, I mean, it was a little later than that. It was probably 2012, I think, or maybe even later, but I remember NBC News in the morning waking up and seeing the line, you know, on the byline on the bottom, oldest and largest drug treatment program in the United States declares bankruptcy. I remember being so very upset with the New York, you know, the people running the program, because that's how I found out about the bankruptcy. Now, obviously, there were lots of reasons, and the lawyers were advising them. But reputationally, yeah, we were very concerned that, you know, we didn't want people to think. And actually, back then, we were fairly financial strong. Our own financial difficulties didn't come until the state really moved us out from one department to the other, and the whole funding mechanism changed.
Right.
But, I think New York declared bankruptcy in 2014 and then became a part of what's now Samaritan Daytop in 15. Now, although my years could be off here or there, but it generally was around that time. I'm pretty sure it was bankruptcy 14. They merged into what's now Samaritan Daytop in 2015.
Well, we knew the writing was on the wall. And Joe pretty much at that point made it his life's mission to do the best he could to insulate both, you know, New Jersey and California from what was transpiring. In New York. And like you never forget that Saturday morning. I'll never forget the phone call that I got, and this was in 2006, mind you, and we were in the middle of getting ready to expand up into Redding, California, lovely facility, for one of those $1 a year leases. And Joe called me, and he said, you know, prior to that, in the very late 90s, New York had refinanced our property in Redwood City and pulled out $1.1 million and parked it in the bank in Yonkers, New York. And that money was going to be used for expansion. And he called me and said, Orville, you know that money that was parked in the bank in Yonkers? I said, yeah. He said, New York used it. And of course, I said, what? He said, yeah, they had to use it to make payroll. And he said, we're not getting it back. I said, oh, my goodness. So that obviously ended any thought of expanding up into Redding, California. And then, of course, it highlighted and really for us to figure out a plan to separate, if you will, for lack of a better term, which eventually did happen. And I tell you, nothing made Joe more happy than when that deal was closed. And we struggled even after the separation because, you know, being a part of Daytop, we had access to the credit line and all that stuff, and all that went away with the separation. So we struggled for a while, but, you know, his happiness was that we didn't get dragged down, New Jersey didn't get dragged down because of what was going on, specifically at Daytop, New York. So 2009, 2010 rolls around. I believe it was the spring of 2010 where Joe had his retirement ceremony. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I took over for him September 2009. I had been in New York from 2007 to 2009, and the plan was not to go back to New Jersey, but Father Joe and I, Father Joe had, you know, he was having some health problems and really needed to dedicate more time for his own treatment in his life, and we had talked about that. And quite frankly, I saw the writing on the wall in New York, too. You know, that making the trouble and difficulty, the challenge to make payroll was happening far too often. So then I accepted I didn't become president and CEO until we completely separated. So we then, by that time, we were a membership corporation with New York and the foundation as the member. And so that was September of 2009. You're right. And I believe it was April of 2010. We had, you know, the Father Joe's quote-unquote retirement dinner with 300 or 400 people in that room. I believe that was at the Madison Hotel, another beautiful venue. And we celebrated it, and it was a major fundraiser. I think we netted 300,000 or 400,000 that evening. And yeah, so that, you're right, that would have been probably April of definitely spring of 2010. Yes.
Yeah. And Chris, just so you can visualize it in your mind, we're sitting in this room, 300-400 people, and at some point in the ceremony, it gets to the point where things are either being auctioned off or what have you, and the dollar figures that have been that are being thrown around and donated and purchased for this and that and whatnot is only stuff we could have dreamed of.
Yes, sure, I imagine.
25,000 here, 30,000 here. I was just looking at Linda. I said, can you believe this?
My goodness, yeah, wow.
But Jimmy, we were invited to attend that. So here's an unknown story that connects that you weren't aware of. Okay, so Linda and I go out. Unbeknownst to you and unbeknownst to us, Brian Madden is attending this celebration also. Okay.
Right.
Whereas 19 years earlier, Brian Madden is the one that made a decision, if you will, or an approval for Linda and I when we lost a child to pay, and we had no money, to pay for us to fly back to England along with the casket to bury the child in England. And I knew Brian had approved it. And I told Linda, but obviously she doesn't know who Brian Madden is, so on and so forth. And just as the universe would have it, we were seated at his table. And I was finally able to thank him in person 19 years later. And he remembered and introduced Linda to him as the person who approved that wonderful gesture by the organization for us, which we were extremely grateful for. So it's just interesting how things come full circle, people come together. But that was a wonderful ceremony. I'm glad we were able to make it and see Mendham. So I'll never forget that. So here we are. You guys are continuing on forward 2009, 10, 11, 12. When do you start to sense that there's a change in the air in the state and the impact, the negative impact it may start to have on your program?
In 2012, clearly, there were two things going on simultaneous. One, we were starting to see far fewer kids being referred to treatment and being referred. Back then, the state didn't have to approve it. Well, they did, in a way, have to approve admissions, as long as you met admission criteria. But I remember in 2012, the other thing we were starting to see, and it was devastating, is we were starting at DATEP in New Jersey, we were starting to really see and feel the heroin epidemic. You know, we saw it, the devastation. And I remember, quite frankly, it was mission-driven, but we had all these beds and slots open. Kids weren't being weren't being sent. So it was certainly mission driven, and it was a business decision, quite frankly, to expand and extend our mission. At that time, it was going to be just young adults. So in our Morris County outpatient program, we started serving young adults. I think it was 18 to 24. And that didn't last long, because I remember that certainly the people that were running the drug court in that county and the other human services people, the administrator of the county, I remember them coming and saying, we really appreciate that you're serving, our brothers and sisters here in the county, you're serving our children, but please don't stop at 24. We need so much help. So it was maybe for about a six-month period we were adolescent and young adult, and then because of the need, we quickly became an adult treatment provider. At that point, it was just an outpatient level, and so that was 2012. But in 2015, the state of New Jersey announced that they were taking the adolescent residential treatment providers out from under the adult system, because we were in the, back then it was called Division of Addiction Services under Department of Human Services. Today it's Division of Mental Health and Addiction Services, still under the New Jersey Department of Human Services. But they were transferring us, taking us, there was only six of us, I believe, that were providing residential treatment to kids. Kids, when I say kids, I mean 18 and under, really. It's supposed to be 17 and under. And that was in 15. We got moved out to Department of Children and Families, and learned very quickly that their mantra was keep kids at home, in school, and out of trouble. And that was 2015. And the stark reality was that what they were basically saying is the research indicated that kids would do better if you kept them at home, if you kept them with their immediate family. If not immediate family, then kinship care or even foster care, as opposed to quote-unquote institutionalizing them. What was so very frustrating about it, and Orville, I know you know this and appreciate this, we weren't an institution. We were not a prison. We were not a juvenile detention center. It was a family. Now, granted, there were 65, 70 kids living there with lots of staff, but it was a family-like environment. By that time, we had a full-time special education high school. We had something that no substance use treatment program certainly had in New Jersey, and I'm not sure, in the Northeast did one exist to it. We had built a 35,000-square-foot state-of-the-art school. It was a special ed high school. The kids were going to school 5.5 hours a day, getting the same coursework and credits that they would get at their local school. It was really, really magnificent. We weren't an institution. However, we were licensed as such. Mm-hmm. In the end, it was just a matter of, okay, we're not, where maybe we used to do 200 or 300 admissions in a year for kids in our programs, we were doing 75. And financially, it strangled us. It really strangled us. Eventually, we held on. As a matter of fact, one by one, those organizations who were similar to the program in Daytop and Mendham, and by then, we had opened up a program in the southern part of the state, which was really a sister facility, a beautiful 13-acre campus, another 50-bed program. First, it was for all boys. Then it was co-ed. But we started to see the same reality there. Mm-hmm. This tremendous inertia, quite frankly, to keep kids out of the quote-unquote institution. And, we had to kind of really get back to re-looking at our strategic plan. And that's what really eventually led to our decision and the board's decision to let's go and find a merger partner, which is what we did actually in the middle of the pandemic. We merged into the organization that we are now October 1st of 2020. I can't believe next week will be 4 years already.
Mm. what services are you now providing?
Oh, it's a pretty big, we're in, you know, the organization is called Ascender Integrated Health. We have mental health outpatient. We have SUD outpatient. We have beautiful 10-bed facility for moms with an opioid use disorder and their children. And we have a wellness and recovery centers in 12 of the 21 counties. And then, you know, so those are the programs that you would say were similar to probably what you're doing or similar to what, you know the old daytime programs. But we're the first, we launched the first public health institute in the state of New Jersey, June of 2023, and we're really proud of it. It's the first one, to our knowledge, founded in New Jersey with a core value of equity. So we're doing public health, we do maternal health, we do in-home counseling, nurse visitation. We have lots of programs, Department of Children and Families programs, things called Keeping Families Together, Family Success Centers. We do some housing, some supportive housing, some voucher, scattered site housing. So it's a really fully adept, fairly large, diverse in terms of services, and diverse really in terms of our whole approach to human and social services. So it's behavioral health and then lots more, let's put it that way.
It's, to me, it's almost a natural, just in terms of providing the service, a natural evolution. Because if you think about what Daytop provided holistically, that it made available, let's say, to people who went through, it was unheard of.
Yeah. I think what we know today is that we have to be, if we're really going to have the impact that people deserve, is you have to really be focused on the social drivers of health, you know, and that's how we would get into maternal health. That's how we got into housing. That's how we got into public health, really, and began to provide public health programming, because we know that if we're ever going to have the impact that people really need, you've got to be all over the social drivers, the social determinants of health. Can't just provide addiction treatment in a vacuum. It's not going to say it doesn't help, but I don't think it's good enough, quite frankly. It's not good enough for the people who need the help.
Chris, Mr. Producer, he's our director of operations, by the way. That's right up your alley. You've been saying that for years.
Yeah, it's really fascinating sitting back and hearing everything that you have to say, Jimmy. I've been kind of touting that for a long time. The system, I don't believe the system is doing a justice to the clients who are in the system and need the help when they operate in such a siloed fashion, where you have housing in one arena and they don't care anything about mental health or addiction. And you have mental health in one arena and they don't really care about housing or addiction. And you have addiction who's separate and apart from housing and mental health. And you're really not looking at the person as a whole and all of their needs. And if everybody could get on the same page and say, look, forget the chicken or the egg argument. The fact is they need housing and they need addiction treatment and they need mental health treatment. And how can we all get on board and making the client whole? And it, you know, obviously that's easier said than done, and that's a huge kind of political battle. But you're absolutely right. You can't just treat one of them and ignore the others, or you're not doing the help that we're here to do.
Absolutely. Well said, Chris. Well said. And those silos that you speak about, certainly in government, the federal government, state government, you know, are just so inefficient and are so expensive. And, you know, and I'll say it, you know, really not intentionally, but, you know, because those silos are in place, just as you described them, such a waste of taxpayer money.
Oh,
such a drain even on private systems than there really should be. You know, we learned a long time ago that integrated care, you know, when we talk about integrated care, you think about behavioral health and primary health care, right? Of course, that's integrated care, but integrated care really needs to be much more than that. People have to work. They have to have good health care. Their kids need access to school. Their kids need access to Head Start so they can go out and work. You know, they need housing, safe and supportive housing. You got to have a job. You know, without these things all coming together, it's amazing to me. You know, it's amazing to me how many people, when I think about data, you know, over the last 50 years, but it's amazing to me to think how many people actually came out of it and were okay, right, in spite of, you know, operating in a siloed system, in a siloed system of care. But just think about, right, if we knew then what we know now, what those numbers, and I don't say that in a coarse way at all, but those numbers all represent one life, one family, one community. I think we're starting to kind of get it now, but, you know, God knows we've got a long way to go in the future, too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Jimmy, what were those conversations like with the board when you knew that you had to go in a different direction, including the conversations about, hey, we need to merge with another organization?
Well, at first it was, are you sure? Come on. We just had $1 million dinner last year. How could we need to merge? We just netted $1 million in 2019. And I said, yeah, but, you know, this was, think about it. I mean, I didn't, you know, we had decided to merge. We had submitted the paperwork. We were waiting for the approvals before the pandemic. But, we, you know, in 2019, we just did a dinner and, you know, we netted over $1 million. It could have been $1.2 million. And the board thought, you know, quite frankly, the board thought we were, you know, wow, that was great. But what they didn't understand is that at that point, we were exceeding 10% of our revenues, our budgeted revenues, you know, on fundraising. So we were deficit funding our programs through private philanthropy, which was okay. But honestly, I would never go back and do that again because it's just not sustainable over the long term. And yeah, obviously that proved to be right because in 2020, there were no dinners. There were no galas. There were no fundraisers. There were no honorees. People didn't know what was coming next. And so eventually, you know, through our executive committee of the board and our finance committee of the board, people began to see the reality, but not just the reality, but the opportunities that, quite frankly, joining a much more stable, robust organization or system with more resources than we could have ever dreamed of having was a smart move. It was a way to kind of fly the flag under another, you know, under another organization, but keep the mission very much alive. And, you know, that process that I, you know, we probably went back and forth for a good 12 to 18 months, you know, and I had some people lined up, some organizations lined up that, you know, we had choices, right? The power of choice. We weren't just going to merge with anyone, you know, who was going to come and promised to write a check, but we had some choices lined up, and that was really good and really, I think, empowering to the board members. They got to meet with the other CEOs. They got to look at the books. They got to look at the financials. They got to look at the service descriptions. They got to look at the impact, the locale, and in the end, we made the best decision going forward for Daytop, New Jersey. But in the beginning, you know, it was really difficult. You talk about having lots of very, very difficult conversations. There were lots of them. I don't think I could count that high how many difficult conversations we had to have.
How did the staff take it?
At first, the staff were devastated. You know, at first, the staff, I mean, obviously, my executive team was aware. The staff were devastated, but you know, we were really open and transparent. We were really open and transparent. And the staff had begun to see, and I just feel in their own pocketbooks too, that leading up to that, we were starting to have some real financial financial difficulties that were affecting them where we had to go a year or two without cost of living increases or without any kind of, you know, with putting the merit, you know, or maybe the benefits getting a little tighter. So, I mean, I don't think it was a major surprise, but especially for the staff who were, you know, well-tenured, and we were very fortunate back then to have lots of staff, you know, 10 years, 20 years. Mm-hmm. Few of us were 25 years at the time. So it was difficult, and some left, you know, some said, I'm going to go, I'm going to, you know, go somewhere else. And everybody, I think, had to make decisions that was best for them and their families at the time.
Did you, was there any ever a conversation about what the new organization would be named? Was there a conversation about continuing the Daytop name in some fashion? How did those talks go?
Well, the organization that we had merged into, Ascenda Integrated Health, headquartered in Glassboro, New Jersey, right by Rowan University. I don't know what your listeners know or don't know about New Jersey. It's really a beautiful part of the state. But I don't really even know how to describe it. It was just really, you know, something very much, very difficult. But, it very difficult. But at the same time, I think, you know, because there was a series of meetings for over a year, and then the pandemic obviously delayed it. But as our team started to meet with their team, let me put it to you this way. As our team started to meet with their team, they had just merged. The organization was a group called Robin's Nest, which was a very child welfare-centric organization operated in the southern part of the state since the late 1960s. And in 2019, they kind of took over a community-based mental health organization and a substance use mental health treatment organization in the surrounding area. The three of them merged and formed the quote-unquote new company, Ascenda Integrated Health. And then Daytop joined 15 months later. So it was a lot. You know, it was really a lot. It was a new, but not so new. And I had gotten to know the CEO there very well. I knew him from meetings over the years and being in professional advisory committee meetings with him and serving on other committees with him. Well-respected, bright guy, just a great guy. And but it was very difficult, so we merged. But honestly, Orville, the name Daytop remaining was never in the cards, and I knew that.
I knew that.
Part of what I appreciated was everybody was very transparent about the process.
Mm-hmm. So basically, you have an organization that has come together, like four different organizations, and ultimately came together to make one. Was any one of them had the existing name, or that was a newly formed name?
Newly formed name.
Okay. Interesting. Very interesting. Did you feel like, as the best way I can ask this question, and you may have partially answered this, did you feel that you were merging as equals, or were you in the power position or a lesser position? How did you view Daytop New Jersey's entry into the merger?
We certainly weren't in the position of control, the power position. I don't really think lesser position. Maybe we were because we weren't the controlling organization. We had to negotiate things like how many board seats, and, you know, it wasn't really lots to negotiate. But the organization that was created the year before already had the board established. So they were they had decided on the name. They had been through a whole branding process. And, you know, and I was aware of this because our discussion and consideration of merging into this group was already a possibility. We just hadn't decided it because we were talking to another organization at the time. But no, I mean, we certainly weren't the controlling group going into the process, you know, or at the culmination of the process.
Chris knows why I'm kind of asking these questions, because we see on the horizon in the future, not just for us, but for others, that a alcohol and drug program administrator for our county, who's now retired, but when he was hired in the late 2000s, one of the announcements he made, he looked around the room, he saw about 14 or 15 providers, and he said, my vision is that we're going to end up with six, instead of having 14 or 15 struggling providers, we're going to have six strong providers. And
yeah,
nearly 15, 17, 18 years later, I'll be damned if his vision is not on the way to happening. So we've always been talking internally about, you know, if that should ever come to pass for us, but out of, you know, strengthening us, but not, you know, because there have been some quote-unquote mergers, but they weren't really mergers. They were more like acquisitions.
Well, you know, and in many ways, the Daytop folding into Ascender was an acquisition too. But you know, we just don't like to call them that way in the nonprofit arena. But they really it was, and it kind of worked out. I'll tell you another thing about the, you know, behavioral health mergers and where we are at today, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of it. This is kind of hot off the press since July, but our organization is, I think, as nonprofits go, we are as financially strong as, you know, as the next guy. Let's put it that way. You know, it's a 700-employee, $65 million organization with 40 locations, over 100 programs, right? And we, in July, hot off the press, we filed paperwork to become an affiliate of a much larger Pennsylvania-based organization where there'll be 11 other affiliates in New Jersey, complementary in terms of services, geographic region, in terms of services, and together our system of care, because we know that as strong as we are now, does not mean, you know, we're competing with hospitals, big healthcare systems. Now, the competition in behavioral health, the competition in substance use disorder treatment, mental health treatment today, for obvious reasons and for many reasons, is not what it was years ago. So we are looking for ways to strengthen our own organization, and we think we'll save money on expenses, health insurance, and I don't know about California, but New Jersey now in January, probably three-quarters of our facilities will be moved into the behavioral health carve-in. We're going to a value-based care system, and we soon will be discussing and negotiating rates with the five companies in New Jersey that will be paying, the five major insurers in New Jersey that will be paying for people to receive our services. And as a $65 million organization with 700 employees and 40 locations and 100 programs, Orville, we don't have the leverage. We don't have the bargaining or purchasing power. But when you put us all together, now, you know, when we're looking at maybe 250,000 covered lives a year, now the insurance companies, I hate to put it this way, but the insurance companies have to take us seriously. And the world of behavioral health treatment is so rapidly changing. I mean, the mergers, the organizations, the smaller nonprofits that didn't survive the pandemic, the organizations that are going out of business because their whole pot of funding was Medicaid dollars, it's really tragic. And I think you're 100% right to be thinking about, okay, how do we strengthen not just our bottom line going forward, but how do we kind of make our impact grow? How do we make our impact even greater? You know, today, to run these organizations, you have to have much more of a business mind and many more resources, really, to accomplish what you need to accomplish.
Does this all sound familiar, Chris?
Yeah. Sounds like conversations that might as well have been recorded that we've been having.
No, I know it's they're necessary. They're really necessary. It's very difficult, but times are really difficult out there, and times are difficult here. Times are difficult all over the country, and let's face it too. And again, I'm not embarrassed to say it. The opioid epidemic, right, caused devastation and damage and destruction throughout the country, more so in different pockets. But organizations with an eye on profit realized that this epidemic, now the fentanyl epidemic, with the opioid, the fentanyl epidemic, creates pathways to lots of profit for some organizations. And organizations like ours, nonprofits, it forces us to have to be much more competitive. We're going to have to be able to compete. We're going to have to be able to have the resources and, quite frankly, the profit to pay our staff competitively if we want to keep a strong staff. Workforce development is our big workforce right now, and I'm sure it's you guys would identify, but it's our biggest challenge. It's what keeps us up at night, ensuring we've got a workforce in place that's highly competent, well-paid, and is not looking to jump ship, quite frankly.
I'm beginning to wonder, Jimmy, if you've been secretly tapping into some of our conversations.
We're all kind of in the same position, Chris. We really are, and it's just.
That's funny because when Joe first came out here, he attended one of our provider meetings, and when we were driving back to the facility, he was just shaking his head and that laugh he has, and he said it doesn't matter where you are in the country, it's the same conversations.
Isn't. You're right, Orville, and today, 25, 30 years later, right, when Father Joe first said that, it's the 20-whatever, it's the same reality, really is the same reality. Yeah, and, the other thing is no one organization can kind of do it on their own anyway. You got to, strategic partnerships, I think, are so important for survival, but so important that the mission can remain vibrant.
Well, Jimmy, this has been a very enlightening conversation, and also a pleasant conversation, because I have to say, I did not know that Daytop, New Jersey had merged. I thought they had closed.
Okay.
And so
yes,
me on that.
Closing was never in the cards, thank God.
Yeah, that's a wonderful bit of news. And this is why we wanted to have these conversations with people, so that they could either set the record straight from what may be presumed, but also, as we noted in the beginning, that we want to put these things on the record so anyone, when they want to, can learn about Daytop, New Jersey, how it came about, and how it evolved to where it continues in spirit today.
That's fantastic, and hopefully we can stay in touch. And Chris, hopefully I'll get to meet you too. But thank you, really, thank you for calling on me for this. You brought back lots of great memories, and also, Orville, with your questioning, you helped me have to sharpen up my mind as far as the timeline and think about it, because so much has passed. But it was great talking to you guys, and hopefully we can stay in touch.
All right, Jimmy. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Have a great night, guys. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You too.
Thank you, Jimmy. All right, sir. Well, what a fantastic interview. What a great guy, Jimmy, and sound, that's just almost gives me goosebumps the way he's talking about what he's talking about, and it's just mirroring exactly the conversations we've been having. So great to get that one in the archives, and great to be able to look back on that one. And I get the feeling that Jimmy won't be a stranger. We might be keeping in touch with this man regularly.
Yep. Picking his brain.
That's right. That's right. All right, sir. Well, is there anything else you want to let the audience know before we wrap it up here?
No, but that other than that, we'll continue to try and source out some people, some former leaders of Daytop, and keep this thing going about preserving the history of Daytop Village.
Love it. All right, folks, you heard it from the host's mouth. We'll try and keep the history of Daytop alive, so look out for the future when we may have more guests on, whether you're going to join live or listen in the archives in the podcast library. It was great to get back on the air with everybody, so we wish everybody a safe and a productive week here and a fun weekend, and we'll catch everybody at the next one. Be well.
Seems like yesterday, but it was long ago. There in the darkness with the radio playing low, and the secrets that we share, the mountains that we move, caught like a wildfire out of control, till there was nothing left to burn and nothing left to prove. Lost my way. There were so many roads.